The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The Biden administration faces a test of the president's mettle with challenges from both Russia and China.
I think the biggest factor in all this red line stuff is whether the target of the red line believes the United States will actually follow up.
Former President Donald Trump returns to the Salem Radio Network.
China has hurt our country and has hurt the world.
Senator Tom Cotton leads a growing chorus of voices concerned over the upcoming Winter Olympics in Beijing.
I've called for a complete and total boycott.
Plus, 80 years on, we'll look back at the attack on Pearl Harbor.
It was a strategically stupid thing to do.
With an explanation of why Japan moved forward with that attack.
They thought we were predictable, they thought we were weak, and thought we wouldn't attack.
I'm Hugh Hewitt, great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program, please, as well at Town Hall Review. On Tuesday this past week, President Biden held a two-hour virtual meeting with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. The catalyst for the conversation is the dramatic buildup of Russian troops at the Ukrainian border. Putin's specific plans are not clear. But, according to the New York Times, some 175,000 troops may be prepared for some sort of invasion. I was not alone in this observation. President Biden's message to Putin was not one of strength. I turned to Byron York of the Washington Examiner. You know, China's doing stuff in space, attacking our satellites. You have a red line in space. And the Secretary of Defense responded thus, cut 13.
But I always found that it's never a good idea to publish red lines.
Stop right there.
I would say that it's...
What's that mean to you, Byron?
First of all, I think the word publish is important. It doesn't mean the same as set. It means the difference between making a threat privately versus making a threat publicly. So I can't say what the administration has done privately that I don't know about. But I think the biggest factor in all this red line stuff is whether the target of the red line believes the United States will actually follow up, will actually do it. And I'm not sure that either China or Russia should believe that Joe Biden will actually do what he says. I mean, if you make a threat to somebody, you have to be prepared to follow up on it. Now, with Trump, when Donald Trump did something like killing Soleimani, the Iranian leader, I mean, I think everybody in the world went, wow, you know, he'll do something.
Yep.
That increases the power of a threat exponentially if you've done something. So I don't think Biden has that right now.
Do you remember when the Russians came over the hill in Syria and the Americans mowed them down?
Yes.
That is a red line. Don't come over that hill again. That's like in blood, a red line in blood. So I think what he said was incredibly provocative. If he had said, I have told and the president has told Putin and Xi our red lines, don't worry, don't count on that. But I'm not going to tell you, Brett. That would have been fine. I don't think we have any red lines. I don't think this president has in his entire, you know, 5, 6, 7 decade long career. I don't know how long it is. I don't think he's ever articulated a red line.
Well, he became, he became a senator in 1973. So he's entering, he's nearing his 50th year of this sort of stuff. And I did hear you refer to Robert Gates before. So I think we should actually read the portion of Robert Gates's memoir in which he discussed Biden. Quote, he's a man of integrity, incapable of hiding what he really thinks, and one of those rare people you know you could turn to for help in a personal crisis. Still, I think he's been wrong on nearly every major foreign policy and national security issue over the past 4 decades. That's 40 years. That is a long time.
Putin and his aspiration for some sort of territorial acquisition from Ukraine could be Exhibit A in how our adversaries respond when they sense weakness from our senior leader. Exhibit B would have to be China. I discussed both with former President Donald Trump this week. President Xi is a killer. He's got a genocide going on in China. Should we have anything to do with these Olympics? I know you have to get along with the people that are there when you take office, but it's a genocide, Mr. President.
So Jimmy Carter did the Olympic thing and it didn't work out. And we have much bigger things that we can do. No, China has hurt our country and has hurt the world very badly. Hurt the world worse than they've hurt us.
So I want to ask especially about the hypersonics that China launched. Did you know they were coming? This is a game-changing weapon that they have launched on President Biden's watch. Did you know they were about to do that?
I knew that I started it. So Russia started it after they got our information. You know, somebody gave them, during the Obama administration, everything we had on hypersonic. And Russia did it. And what I did is a catch-up program, and we've largely caught up. But what happened is Russia got it, and then China got it perhaps from Russia. I doubt they did it themselves. They got it perhaps from Russia, maybe from some bad spy in the United States. But you know what happened. Russia got the, you know, how-to, the knowledge from the United States. They did it, and Obama didn't do it. I caught up with it. How China got the information, I don't know, but I had heard that they had information. But we've started that program very heavy under my administration. I don't know what they're doing about it now with Biden.
Is President Biden or Vice President Harris tough enough to deal with Russia and China?
I think you know the answer to that.
The Winter Olympics, of course, are scheduled for Beijing early next year. Keen observers are watching closely whether or not they will take action against Taiwan, perhaps shortly after those games are concluded in late February of 2022. I turn to a regular on my program, Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. Ahead of Biden's democracy summit, China says, we're also a democracy. And it quotes this, quote, there is no fixed model of democracy. It manifests itself in many forms, the State Council, China's top governing body, argued in a position paper it released over the weekend. China's democracy that works. That is so stupid that I just want you to be the first to say so on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
That is very stupid, Hugh. China's insistence that it's democracy reminds me of Soviet Union and all of its satellite countries, who always included words like democratic and republic in the title of their government or in their communist parties, makes you think they protest a little too much. I do have to say, though, that I'm not sure what the president plans to accomplish in this so-called summit for democracy, other than perhaps offending the democracies that he did not invite, such as our NATO ally Hungary or Singapore, the little Sparta in Southeast Asia. It's not clear to me what's going to be a lasting accomplishment here other than harming our relationship with some vital allies.
You know, nothing is clear to me about Team Biden. Poor Jake Sullivan has got to be octagon because he's got to answer 8 phones at a time to try and clean up every mess. I was on Brett Baer's special report last night. The diplomatic boycott came up. My position is it's better late than never, and it's better something than nothing, but no American corporation should spend a dollar on this. Do you agree or disagree with that, Senator Cotton?
Well, yeah, Hugh, that's the least that we can do. Both the diplomatic boycott and corporations like Coca-Cola not spending a dollar in Beijing. As you probably know, I've called for a complete and total boycott. I sent the Biden administration a letter about 6 months ago asking them how they were going to protect our athletes in China. They sent back a letter through classified channels, Hugh, although there's nothing classified about it. In fact, it's not marked classified. But the reason they did that, I think, is because they have no plan. They have no plan to protect our athletes from ubiquitous electronic and technical surveillance in Beijing or from DNA harvesting under the guise of coronavirus testing. For that matter, outright hostage taking. And if China will disappear one of its own star tennis athletes and trot her out for hostage videos, despite the condemnation of the civilized world, what do we think they'll do to one of our athletes? And then, of course, course, there's China's genocide against its own people and cracking down on the autonomy of Hong Kong that they committed themselves to. I don't think the United States should be participating in these games.
You recall, Senator, because you were the first public official, elected official to the bell on COVID, that early in the pandemic, China tried to blame American athletes who had visited Beijing, Wuhan months before for the pandemic. I do not doubt that they will blame our athletes for whatever goes wrong in China after these games. And I just can't believe we're not doing a better job. I just talked with your colleague, Senator Cruz, who came up with the Cruz Doctrine, which is only journalists who intend to vote in Republican primaries should ask questions at Republican debates, ditto Democrats. Because if that had been the case, Joe Biden would have been asked about the genocide in China 2 years ago when he should have been asked about it, Senator. What do you think of the Cruz Doctrine?
Well, I think, Hugh, that we need to be more mindful of who moderates and questions at Republican debates. You don't have to be an opinion journalist from the right to moderate one of those debates, but you have to be someone who's attuned to what Republican voters think and who ask questions that we care about. I mean, the most infamous example of this was George Stephanopoulos.
Yes.
In the 2012 election cycle, asking some question about birth control when none of the Republican candidates had ever said anything about the issue and no Republican voters probably cared to hear about it. Yet George Stephanopoulos was essentially carrying water for Barack Obama and the Democratic Party, asking questions that were designed to trap Republicans in some kind of stupid gotcha statement.
Let me go, Senator, to this better, Build Back Better. Every single Democrat is going to own every dollar that is spent. There's $170 billion in this bill that's going to go for failed approaches to homelessness and affordable housing. It will make problems worse, not better. There's $3 billion for tree equity. There's $200 million for the Presidio. Do your Democratic colleagues realize they own every dollar, every idiot measure in this bill if they pass for it, if they vote for it?
Well, that may be one reason why they haven't been able to get the votes for it yet in the Senate, Hugh, as they started to look at that dog's breakfast of a bill that came out of the House of Representatives and pumped the brakes pretty hard. I mean, $200 million for Nancy Pelosi's hometown park, $3 billion for tree equity, whatever in the world that means, or all that money for those failed homelessness problems when you have just a terrible, terrible homelessness challenge across the country, especially in the West Coast states like California and Washington State. You know, I've heard from so many parents in Washington State who won't even take their kids to public parks anymore because of the homeless who are there, the needles, and all the other problems that accompany homelessness. It's not doing those homeless any favors to continue these failed approaches. It's certainly not doing families any favors. And people like Patty Murray are going to be held accountable by their voters if this bill passes into law.
Coming up.
It was a strategically stupid thing to do because they had no idea of the capability of this country, and we proved it in World War One. They thought we were predictable, they thought we were weak, and thought we wouldn't attack, and unknowingly we lost deterrence.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Tuesday this past week marked the 80th anniversary of a dark day in our nation's history, December 7, 1941, and the attack on Pearl Harbor. That surprise attack precipitated our entrance into the Second World War. But historian Victor Davis Hanson recognizes a concerning level of ignorance about the day that shall live in infamy. VDH was a guest of my friend Dennis Prager.
If I said Pearl Harbor to the average senior in high school in the United States, do you think they would know what I'm talking about?
No. I'm sure of it because I've talked to students of all different. If you'd said the average senior at a named college, I would say no. And I would say to the people who did know about it,
they would say either we egged on the war, to the degree they were half educated, and say, well, we cut off their oil and we went to war about oil in the Middle East, supposedly. So they had no choice. Or it was part of a racial war that had been going on against Asian peoples. But no one would say we were attacked at a time of peace by an aggressive and cruel empire.
How many died at the Pearl Harbor?
It's somewhere between 2,300 and 2,400 and two waves of Japanese surprise attacks. What's amazing about Pearl Harbor was how strategically inept it was on the part of the Japanese and how tactically it was sort of brilliant getting there 4,000 miles in radio silence in the middle of winter, on the onset of winter. But it was a strategically stupid thing to do because they had no idea of the capability of this country, and we'd proved it in World War One. And so within 3.5 years of that attack, we had more ships than all the navies in the world put together, and we had an economy in terms of GDP that was larger than the Soviet, British, German, and Italian economies, and Japanese economy, all put together. So that's what they incurred. And one thing we point out in the video, Dennis, very quickly, is that Admiral Yamamoto is not the tragic, sympathetic haiku poet, artist. He was the person who demanded that they attack Pearl Harbor at a time of peace, or he would resign. He was the one that was worried that the Japanese army might divert its attention to the British and Malaysia, or which they did, or go right into Russia and help the Wehrmacht. He wanted
You were talking about it being a brilliant operation, but if I may use my word, and tell me if I'm wrong, a foolish one.
Yeah, tactically carried out well, but it led to a disaster for the Japanese because they were already engaged in a quagmire in China. Now they had both the British, because they attacked Singapore the next day, and Malaysia, and the British and Hong Kong. And they had the British and the Americans, the only two combatants in World War II that were capable of fighting a two-front war. And they paid a terrible price because they created such righteous anger in the United States with a surprise attack on a Sunday morning without a declaration of war. And they did not have the ability to hit the United States continental mainland and destroy our industry. And we surely did have that potential. And the irony, Dennis, just to finish very quickly, is that when they took out 8 old battleships, damaged 4 and sunk 4 or 5 old battleships that were built before 1920, they didn't realize there was an entire new fleet that was already being built of new sophisticated battleships and carriers. And by early 1943, it started to come online, and that Navy of Essex carriers and North Carolina, Iowa-class battleships was the most sophisticated Navy in the world. It would utterly destroy the Japanese Imperial Navy in just 3.5 years.
So it really, Victor, it really remains, I feel silly even saying this because it might just be a massive lacuna in my knowledge, but I don't know. I never understood why they did bomb Pearl Harbor. What is the ultimate reason?
I think they had been deceived because Germany had invaded Poland since September 1st, and our two closest allies, France, had collapsed in May of 1940 in 7 weeks, and the British people had been bombed relentlessly during the Blitz. And they figured that the United States had not lifted a finger and it had an army about the size of the Portuguese army. And then they felt that the German army was right outside Moscow on December 7th. They had already stalled, but the Japanese figured that was temporary and that they were going to win and the war was going to be over. Europe was over. The only combatant alive, they thought, with the enemy was the British, and they wanted to get in on the spoils as quickly as possible. They thought it was a done deal, and that we either wouldn't intervene and retaliate, or if we did, we would be faced with soon Germany and Italy and Japan and no Soviet Union. So they thought that it would be a wise move. And people, to be fair to the Japanese, people did not trust Yamamoto's idea that he could take out the entire fleet and then we would concede it. But it didn't matter. It was his idea. He threatened to resign if he didn't get his way. And so this idea that he was a strategic genius and that he was killed by American pilots in a hit kind of hurt their chances. It probably helped Japan that he was no longer admiral, because he botched the Midway campaign as well. He divided his forces. So this idea that he was a pacifist or a reluctant warrior and he was a strategic genius is completely not founded on fact.
Did the Japanese ambassador to the U.S. have a reaction?
Yes. I mean, he felt he apologized, but he had the 16-part message. His messages were came in part. So we had decoded them, but we didn't quite know that when they were going to attack. We knew that it was going to be when rather than if. But his whole point was to synchronize his announcement after Pearl Harbor. He was not going to declare war before Pearl Harbor. The whole point was, you Americans made it impossible. In fact, it was worse than that, to have peace. He was engaging in last-minute peace negotiations as the fleet was on its way to Pearl Harbor, so it was a ruse.
And he knew that?
He knew that. He acted like he didn't, and he acted as if he was regretful and that it was too bad that the parties hadn't come to agreement. But everybody said, well, we cut off oil to Japan. We didn't cut off oil until July 1941, and this is after they absorbed half of China, and they had taken French Indochina from the Vichy French, and of course they had enslaved Korea. So it was very late that we finally decided to have sanctions, and yet the revisionists say, well, you know, we kind of deserved it, we cut off their lifeblood. But they didn't really, that didn't really bother them. That wasn't because we cut their oil off, because they had already planned to go into the Dutch East Indies and take over all the Shell oil field. In fact, there was a lot of Japanese very quickly, Dennis, that said, the Netherlands is orphaned now. It doesn't exist. It's under German occupation. France does not exist. If we just go in and take the Dutch East Indies, and we've taken Southeast Asia, and we'll take British Malaya and Singapore, and we will bypass the Philippines and the Pearl Harbor, the United States won't fight. And we'll have all of our all of the possessions and national resources, and we'll only be at war with Britain, who has no chance of winning because they're facing this continental German occupied.
All right. Empire. So in the minute left to us, tell me, can you give me one huge lesson we should learn from Pearl Harbor?
Yes. Deterrence, deterrence, deterrence. Deterrence means that the enemy does not do something stupid and attack you because you have warned them that the retaliation will be so terrible that they'll regret it or they won't exist after. And that's based on two things, military power and then spiritual toughness and the ability to use that power, and also being unpredictable rather than being predictable. So they thought we were predictable, they thought we were weak, and thought we wouldn't attack, and unknowingly we lost deterrence.
Coming up,
we have our own version of tyranny that has now arrived here, and it's already been here.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
This is Jerry Boyer. On the newest edition of Meeting of Minds podcast, I interviewed David Bahnsen, author of the new book, There's No Free Lunch. David here talks about how some of the greatest economists who defended freedom did not understand that it is a gift from God.
And then Hayek came around with price discovery, with the knowledge problem, with the fatal conceit, and you got this intellectual battle that is played out. And yet one thing was missing from it for people like you and me. The leading truth tellers were not Christians.
Right.
The Christian church was absent from the great economic debate of the 20th century. So I won't take away anything that in common grace, Milton Friedman, Friedrich Hayek, Ludwig von Mises contributed to 20th century dialogue.
To hear the entire in-depth interview with Bahnsen about his fascinating book, go to meetingofmindspodcast.com. That's meetingofmindspodcast.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. In some parts of the country, we are in the middle of a deadly pandemic with no end in sight. In other parts of the country, the pandemic occurred over a year ago and we are well past it. The segment of the population in the latter group is growing. The segment of the population in the former group is often running blue states and blue cities. Here's Salem host Charlie Kirk.
Despite the data coming in, example after example of how the most vaccinated countries in the world are experiencing record rates of infection and record rates of transmission, we are seeing our leaders not talk about treatments, not talk about how they can better provide their citizenry with
the information to actually prevent them from getting seriously infected from the Fauci virus. For example, Ireland has a massive COVID outbreak right now. Do you know that 99.5% of all adults over the age of 18 in Waterford are now fully vaccinated? And yet in Ireland, they are seeing a record spike in virus infections. How about in Austria? Now they're saying that unvaccinated people will be formally asked to get vaccinated starting February 15th. Those who fail to do so will face penalties. In Germany, they are locking down the unvaccinated at night. And we have our own version of tyranny that has now arrived here, and it's already been here, using that same sort of emergency use authorization. New York City mayor, he announces that he's going to mandate the vaccine for private sector workers. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio has issued what he calls a preemptive strike, mandating the vaccine to all private sector employees in New York City. He says, we've got Omicron as a new factor. We've got the colder weather, which is really going to create additional challenges with the Delta variant, he says. We've got holiday gatherings. We in New York City have decided to use a preemptive strike to really do something bold to stop the future growth of COVID. Now, we've had Daniel Horowitz on our program. We've had Dr. Malone on our program. The evidence is actually pointing towards this vaccine being a leaky vaccine that is not actually doing what they said it was going to do. It could actually be potentially contributing to the transmission and the spread. That's Daniel Horowitz and Dr. Malone that are saying that. Why do you think that there is a growing sense of skepticism towards this vaccine? Maybe because vaccinated people are getting just as sick, if not more sick. And studies are showing, this is Alex Berenson from the United Kingdom, vaccinated English adults under 60 are dying at twice the rate of unvaccinated people the same age. Let me say that again. According to Alex Berenson and publicly available information from the United Kingdom, vaccinated English adults under 60 are dying at twice the rate of unvaccinated people the same age. This is accounting for age, everybody. Why isn't that being covered by the media? You see, what's happening in New York City with Bill de Blasio now mandating the vaccine for private sector workers, I wish I was surprised, I'm not. This is all about setting the precedent to establish a new baseline. They want to move the window. They want to move the Overton window of what is once deemed radical and unthinkable to now acceptable and policy. This is all about laying the groundwork for future status governmental interventions to micromanage and to control your life. Why are we accepting that this is still an emergency? It's all about setting a precedent, these emergency use powers. And for those of us that love the Constitution and believe it's the greatest political document ever written, the Constitution, which has a preference on checks and balances, independent judiciary, consent to the governed, a bottom-up style of government, we were always concerned that the pandemic was going to make people's appreciation for this, the constitutional system, put that on hold because they were told this is just a temporary suspension of our rights. Now, the reason why they never wanted to talk about ivermectin, vitamin D, azithromycin, aspirin, but the reason that they don't want to have a conversation about prophylactic measures, the reason they don't want to talk about how it's a pandemic of the untreated, not a pandemic of the unvaccinated, the reason they don't want to talk about natural immunity, which is the most obvious thing we should be talking about, is that as soon as people are equipped with the information that hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin or azithromycin or Regeneron or aspirin or vitamin D, any of those things, any of those components could actually liberate you, all of a sudden, Bill de Blasio becomes far less important. All of a sudden, the roadmap of setting a precedent to establish a new baseline, that entire plan gets almost permanently interrupted. Understand they are using the virus to obliterate the Constitution.
Coming up, a look at the lockdowns overseas.
Every day, there are people protesting on the streets.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Much like the United States, there are parts of the world where COVID is mostly a thing of the past. But in other parts of the world, it is treated as the current deadly threat that it is. In Austria, they have locked down the country once again. Theaters, non-essential shops, and bars are now closed. Tourists are banned from hotels. Restaurants are now shut to all but takeaway business. But the people are not happy, and they are fighting back. Conservative Alexander Chugel had led the battle against the shocking treatment of those who distrust the government. He spoke with my friend and colleague, Dennis Prager.
If I'd have told you 2 years ago, would you have believed this would happen?
Unfortunately, I have to say that I already saw some signs, but no, I would have not believed that it comes in the way it came and in the, you know, in this heavy outcome. I was not believing, actually, that they will introduce such rules within such a short period of time.
What party is in power in Austria?
So right now we have a coalition between the so-called Christian Conservative, ÖVP, and the Green Party.
I'm laughing because there are so many parties in Europe that have the word Christian in it. They might as well have the word Buddhist in it.
Yes. There's no Christian thing left there. Hardly. A few exceptions, but...
So is there a genuine conservative party in Austria?
Well, we have a right-wing party, the Freedom Party, FPÖ, which adopted lots of conservative viewpoints during the last decades. And I think from the party program, I would consider them to be a very traditional conservative party now.
Is the Austrian Conservative Party the most successful in Europe? Among conservative parties, that is.
No. One could say that our last chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, was known for being very successful, as he is a new kind of political figure in the political sphere in Europe. He's very young, he's very agile, and so on. But step by step, after the last 10 years of his political work, people saw that he is also more or less just the same as everyone else, mm-hmm. just a little bit younger with another facade in front of him. And now he had to step down because of a corruption scandal and because of the huge pressure by the Austrian people and because of all those draconian measures he implemented.
Oh, he implemented, really, as a conservative?
Yes, so one has to understand that the Austrian Conservative Party is really not what I would call a conservative party. They just have this name. Under Sebastian Kurz, we saw homosexual marriage being introduced. We saw lots of pro-EU, anti-sovereignty laws being introduced, lots of hate speech laws, lots of things which actually censored our free speech. And the totalitarian measures we face right now all started with Sebastian Kurz as the head of the Conservative Party.
All right,
party.
So you don't. All right, then you don't really have a conservative party.
No, as I said, the only classic conservative values you would find today in the right-wing party.
And are they depicted as neo-Nazis?
Well, obviously, yes, they are. But it's more and more difficult, as, for example, the current leader of the FPÖ never had any scandal in his life and lives a very classic Catholic life. He's married, he has children, he lives with his wife next to Vienna. And he's also not in one of those nationalistic organizations. So actually right now, this is not a thing. But obviously leftists want to frame it in this way.
There were demonstrations very recently in Austria, is that correct?
I have to correct you. There are demonstrations, actually, because since the demonstrations started, there was not one day where there was no demonstration going on in Austria. It's already, just imagine, Austria has 8.8 million inhabitants, so less than 9 million. And every day there are people protesting on the streets. On Saturday, the 20th of November, where the big demonstrations happened, there were more than 200,000 people demonstrating all over Austria, about 100,000 to 150,000 in Vienna, the rest in other cities.
Wow. And on
Sunday, there were again 10,000 of people. So it's huge.
Well, I want you to know that I said on my show either this week or last week that it's almost embarrassing that countries with a tiny population compared to the United States have these immense demonstrations against lockdowns and medical passports, and we don't. I have no explanation for it. On the other hand, we obviously have a much more vigorous conservative movement in America than you do in Europe. So you have the demonstrations, and we have the movement. You need a movement, and we need demonstrations.
I think you're totally right. I wanted to ask. Actually, all the listeners of your show and everyone who, in any way, gets in touch with this whole thing, we actually need your support, your American support, because I think if American freedom-loving people ask their political representatives to pressure the Austrian government to stop destroying our freedom and therefore also stop using us as lab rats for the rest of the Western world, then I think this would definitely have an impact.
Your phrase is very powerful. Europeans are lab rats for this experiment in totalitarianism. Now tell me, what is the actual state of the police state movement in Austria?
Right now, to give you an overview over the measures they want to implement right now. We are not allowed to go to a restaurant anymore. We're not allowed to buy certain things. We're not allowed to enter certain shops. And when this lockdown for everybody was presented, our chancellor, former chancellor maybe, Alexander Schallenberg, said from the 1st of February, there will be vaccine mandates for every Austrian starting from the age of 14. 14, just imagine this. So now they want to force us getting the vaccine. But what's next? First, they told us to get two shots. Then they told us to get another shot every fourth month. Now some of them even tell us to get a shot every month. But that's rubbish, obviously. And the state's power certainly doesn't go under our skin. In a country that claims to be a democracy, this has to be unacceptable. So the question is, where does the legitimate power of the state end? We all thought, as Austrians, that this question was definitely answered in 1989 with the fall of the Iron Curtain and the Berlin Wall, and with the fall of communism. But now we see that this is coming again.
Coming up.
It's illegal to visit our families. It's illegal to visit our friends. It's illegal to go eating somewhere.
More on the lockdown in Austria when the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt return.
Hi, I'm Don Crow. This week in The Christian Outlook, sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, China's aspirations for global hegemony have become overwhelmingly clear.
He's building up his military as fast as he can.
80 years after the attack on Pearl Harbor, we'll look back at how the nation woke up.
The Japanese Admiral Tojo said, "I worry that we have awakened a dragon."
We'll also look at the toll of 2 years of pandemic.
Reporters didn't just, not question what was going on, but really abetted what was going on.
And the biological male smashing records in swimming, competing as a woman.
The school is perfectly fine with it. The NCAA is fine with it.
We have all this and more. Be sure to join us and visit our website at ChristianOutlook.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Mandates on masks and vaccination have led to protests, lawsuits, and cries of government overreach here in the United States. But it can get worse, much worse. And we are seeing this play out in other countries, many of them begging for their freedom back. Here's more from Dennis Prager's conversation with Austria's Alexander Chugal.
I want to play for my listeners a minute of your interior minister, Niehammer, speaking. Here's the report.
Speaking on Sunday, the country's interior minister had a stern warning to the Austrian people.
Ab morgen.
As of tomorrow, every citizen, every person living in Austria must be aware that they can be checked by the police at any time. Among other things, we will also check if people have been vaccinated or recovered and the reason for entering public spaces.
Those who currently haven't received two jabs will only be permitted to leave their homes for work and to carry out essential tasks such as shopping and attending medical appointments. The announcement comes following a record surge in COVID infections and government concerns hospitals could become overwhelmed.
Boy, I have to tell you, I admit that this is somewhat emotional and not completely logical or rational. I admit it. I'm giving an emotive response. Hearing a German leader say you could be stopped by the police at any time is particularly scary to hear it in the German language. You don't even have to react, but I will tell you, it sounds bad.
Just to give you an understanding of what our fight here looks like right now, it's illegal to visit our families. It's illegal to visit our friends. It's illegal to go eating somewhere. It's illegal to meet. Just imagine those situations. And yes, the police is checking you. And yes, I am, and I was always a friend of the Austrian police, very good, very competent police in the past. I am suddenly afraid whenever I see a police car, and I'm not alone. The psychological pressure they put upon the Austrian people is unimaginable for someone who does not live in such a country right now. And just imagine right now, they tell you, if you do not continue doing what we tell you, then we will hunt you down with police and put you in prison. Because if you do not pay the fine for being unvaccinated, they put you in prison for 4 to 6 weeks each time you do not pay. And obviously, that's not where it's going to end.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richard, David Bouchon, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.